Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show. Are you approaching retirement, or maybe you've just changed jobs? If so, you'll probably now have control of your 401k or IRA. Would you like to buy some property, notes, loans, start a new business, or even buy crypto? You can with a self-directed IRA. For more than a decade, I've been telling you about setting up a self-directed IRA through IRA Advantage. And while you may now hear other companies say they offer self-directed IRAs, you need to find out if they're truly self-directed. With a truly self-directed retirement account, you can make any investment the law allows. Whether you're talking about true diversification, starting your new business, or investing in private holdings, IRA Advantage through a truly self-directed IRA can make that happen. Take it from me, Lars. You've worked hard for your money. IRA Advantage will work hard to keep it yours.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com. View our videos and call IRA Advantage. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
You think about the Infrastructure Reduction Act.
Yes, she did say the Infrastructure Reduction Act instead of the proper Inflation Reduction Act. And yes, that is Karine Jean-Pierre, the official spokeswoman for Joe Biden, who actually has kind of a hard time speaking for himself, hence the need for a press secretary. But KJP checks all the right boxes for Joe Biden's diversity, equity, and inclusion. She is black, she is female, she is a lesbian, so who cares if she can actually talk as the replacement for Joe Biden, who no longer sits down to do interviews. At least he hasn't done one in the last couple of hundred days. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And if you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every single day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. And I'll get to our Twitter poll here in just a second, but you'll find it two different places for your convenience, since I don't like Twitter, and I know a lot of you don't either, but it is still the Twitter poll until we find a good new home for it. You can find it at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. Maybe Elon Musk will end up having to buy the place after all, but maybe he'll get a better price. Or you can find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. Yeah, Karine Jean-Pierre, can you believe that? This woman stands there and talks about the Infrastructure Reduction Act. $700 billion and change, massive new tax increases, massive new government spending. Most of it is going to go for health care and also for so-called green energy, the same kind of green energy that is leaving an awful lot of Europe in the dark and without the proper heat or cooling, depending on the time of year. But back to Karine Jean-Pierre for just a moment, because I'm going to have some comments about inflation and the newest numbers that we've seen recently. That'll come just a bit later on this hour. But she literally stood there behind the lectern and said, we saw some welcome moderation in the price increases for food at the grocery store. Those are her words on behalf of arguably the most powerful person on planet Earth, the President of the United States. Welcome moderation. Grocery prices last month up 13.5% from last year. That is the biggest increases in the cost of food since 1979, when that idiot peanut farmer from Georgia was president of the United States. Although I have to guess that Jimmy Carter's a happy guy these days. I mean, for decades, the guy was renowned as the least effective and worst president of the United States in modern times. Joe Biden easily eclipses him, and Jimmy Carter can rest easy. But I've got a concern for you. And I want to put it this way. I remember there was a commercial for cell phones about 3 years ago. I think it was T-Mobile. And in the commercial, they talked about people being willing to settle. In fact, at one point, they show some poor guy in a hospital bed waiting for surgery. And he asks his wife, did we get the good surgeon you wanted to find? And she says, well, we got one that's okay. And he looks at her and says, okay. And just that moment, a guy dressed up as a doctor breezes into the hospital room while shouting down the hallway, guess who's off suspension? And he looks at the guy and he says, I'll be your doctor today in surgery. And the patient, he looks at the patient and says, are you nervous? And the patient says, well, yeah. And the doctor says, yeah, me too. We'll see you in a while. And he walks back out the door. And they talk about the fact that you don't have to settle. That was the point of the commercial. You don't have to settle. Well, are we at risk of being forced to settle in America for an America we barely recognize, an America without enough energy, an America without enough workers, an America with just about every part of its infrastructure that actually makes a country function is busted? And guess who's driving the hoopty down the road? That would be Joe Biden, and he's driving us right into a ditch. An America that punishes those who work hard and rewards the lazy and the no account. And we all know plenty of examples of that. In fact, there have been some great recent ones, including that crazy debt repayment for students who kind of went to college, probably dropped out, didn't get a degree that was worth a darn, and now want somebody else to pay the bill. You know, just think about the list of things that we're up against. We settle for electric power that may be on or it may be cut off. We may be blacked out. And this in the most technological country on planet Earth. We settle for forests in the Northwest that catch fire every single summer. The average number of acres of forest burned every single year on average is 691,000 acres. When in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and most of the 80s, the Northwest had no significant forest fires. And by the way, we're now being warned that this is the new normal. PGE and Pacific Power say preventative outages could become the norm. They're warning us. And I've had people say, but Lars, they had to do it to prevent the fires. I said, well, how do you know it prevented the fires? And they say, how do you know it didn't? And I say, because we've had decades where almost every single summer we have at least a short stretch of time where it's hot, where it's dry, where the east winds are blowing. And for some reason, they didn't cut off the power for those, and we didn't have fires. Can I prove what wouldn't have happened this past weekend if we had kept the power turned on? No, I can't. But I can say, if it worked that way for decades and there were no problems, why do it now? We settle for a president who brags about how he's brought down gas prices only months after he finished more than doubling those prices. A president who 1 year ago was telling us inflation is, it's temporary, it's transitory, it'll be here and then it'll be gone. We settle for a border that literally 2 million illegals have crossed in the last year. And then the vice president goes on TV and says, no, our border is secure. She knows she can do that because she can get away with it. We're in an America where nobody even questions ridiculous statements like that. Over that same border, we hear about literally tons of illegal drugs crossing, some of them being caught, knowing that the number of American drug overdoses topped 100,000 literally years ago. And the only question this year is, how much more than 100,000? And when do we hit 200,000? We have homeless encampments occupied by thousands of people in major cities, even fires that broke out. One broke out in Seattle yesterday morning, right there next to Interstate 5, in plain view of tens of thousands of people. But because it's become the new norm, I guess nobody even questions it. Politicians tell us how important education is to America so that they can demand hundreds of billions of dollars on behalf of public teacher unions to fund it. And yet we're told it's okay for kids to graduate who can't read, write, or do math. And that's okay. We can settle for that despite a K-12 public cost of education, K-12, that has now eclipsed $200,000 per child who graduates, and that's if they graduate. How in the world is that going to work? Just consider, if we set new norms like this in America, and the norms are not good for you, they're not good for me, they're not good for anybody who's responsible. But what we do is we reward those who are not responsible, those who do stick to their drug addiction, those who do insist that they are not going to work a job, they're not going to pay taxes, they're not going to pay their bills because somebody else will do it. Well, as a friend once reminded me, Lars, everybody can't ride in the wagon. Somebody has to pull. Glad to be with you on a Tuesday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. And we'll talk about the Northwest nonsense coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense. Right. you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Don't you believe your lying eyes? Slow Joe Biden brags that gas prices have dropped more than a gallon lately. Of course, that comes after prices rose from $2.39 a gallon the day that Joe took office to more than $5 a gallon, more than double. Joe is like one of those discount stores you see that brags about its 50% off sale after they've jacked up prices 200%. The president's energy secretary advises you to save on gas by buying a $60,000 battery car. Sounds like a great way to save money. And VP and border czar Kamala Harris insists that 2 million illegal aliens crossing the American border means that America has a secure border. Now, nobody really questions it. They just drop their jaw that she can actually say that with a straight face. The new inflation numbers, which paused for the month of July at about 8.5% and then dropped a couple of tenths of 1% last month, most of that because of the drop in gas prices. Pay no attention to the food prices, up 13.5%. Yeah, in just the last 12 months, the biggest increase since Jimmy Carter was president back in 1979. Joe Biden and company would like you to ignore all those signs that America is headed for a major recession and supply chain is going to get even worse with some of the planned union strikes that are coming at us right now. Focus on the illegal student loan payoff that's adding almost $1 trillion to the debts, but those are going to be owed by your great-grandkids. Don't you worry about them right now. Just remember, you have a choice in November whether to keep the creeps who did this to your country or throw them out and try something different. From email, Bill writes in, Lars, as you know, I work for the state in child welfare. They just sent an email offering training for affirming children's identities. This gets worse every single day. Glad that I don't have to attend to that garbage. And our question of the day, and I thought it was actually pretty reasonable. Lars, could you report on the Cedar Creek fire and the ongoing efforts? The fire is now at 94,000 acres with zero containment. I have no idea what the costs are so far, but they have to be substantial and they're only going to rise. I understand that flame retardant is expensive and damaging to water supplies, but this fire is out of control. The risk to the fire crews is huge. Wildlife and other natural resources are being destroyed, and there's no end in sight. I appreciate all of the efforts put forth and the communities of Oak Ridge, Westphal, and other areas were protected. I just feel that more needs to be done, but I'm unsure who's responsible for the decisions being made and the reasons behind them. Signed, Diane Branson. Well, if you take a look at what happened, the fire, the Cedar Creek fire that's now at zero containment with 94,000 acres, and if that changes today, I'll be glad to update that. Do you know when that fire began? It is now the 13th of September. The fire began during a lightning storm on the 1st of August, not quite 1.5 months ago. It caused the evacuation or threatened 2,200 homes. They have about 3,500 people living in those towns. Evacuations were ordered on Friday. The fire began on the 1st of August. Now, can I point out the pattern? Because over the years, I've taken issue with things like the Chetco Bar fire, which was identified in the middle of July at about 1/4 acre. It then grew to hundreds of thousands of acres, but it took over a month to do that. And I've asked, why don't we put these things out early? Now, early on in this summer, we saw the Department of Forestry actually out very quickly extinguishing fire. In fact, I'll repeat some of the numbers that they gave out. They said in most years, by this point in the year, it was late July, we have about 5,000 acres that have burned. This year, somehow they kept out to 500, only a tenth as much. And why? Because they put the fires out early. Now, I understand that there are fires that get going, and with winds, you can't put them out because they move quickly. But when one of the biggest fires around, the one that's at zero containment right now, started 1.5 months ago, it makes you wonder, why not put it out then? And I've heard all the arguments about rough terrain. Fine, if you've got a fire that's in tough terrain and it's only 10 or 20 acres at that point, why not put a big fire line around it and make sure that it only gets that big? Instead, you're at 94,000 acres. It might have been worth sacrificing even a few hundred acres around that fire to keep the fire from getting bigger. To some extent, the approach seems to be, well, yeah, there's a fire, but an awful lot of fires started by lightning just burn out. In these kind of dry conditions, not that likely. So it just seems to make sense. Get on the fires early, get them put out fast, and for goodness sake, get that global super tanker back on the air for in the air so that it can go out and go after the fires for which it's appropriate. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
The way has been paved by Trademark Paving. Just pave it. Serving Southwest Washington.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to the city of Seattle, and here's why. Our friends at Como News up in Seattle, which is the sister station to KVI, which is our affiliate for Seattle, they point out that yesterday morning, right next to Interstate 5, the fire department had to be called for a fire at a homeless encampment. The fire began along 12th Avenue South in Judkins, but right next to Interstate 5. And if you say, well, that's sad, it's too bad there was a fire. There was a fire there because people were allowed by the city of Seattle to camp in a problematic area. Any area that can catch fire because, even though it's staying very, very warm these days, if you have a warming fire, if you have a cooking fire, if you are maybe firing up your methamphetamine that you have to smoke, you're allowing this kind of thing to happen. And here's what I'd like to see some enterprising reporter ask the folks at the city of Seattle. Why is it that every single city in this region enforces code on tax-paying, law-abiding folks? Now, clearly, those homeless encampments violate the code about six ways from Sunday, and yet they do not enforce the very same code that they enforce on tax-paying, law-abiding folks on the thousands of drug-addicted squatters. And you set up a situation where you can have fires like that inside a city. So you've got not just wildfires from bad management of regional forests, but you have fires inside of cities that put lives and safety at risk because a city that will enforce the code on regular folks all day long will not do it when it comes to the drug-addicted squatters. That one makes no sense to me. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Mobile Joe's RV Collision. Get back on the open road and back to your adventure with Mobile Joe's. No body damage, too big or small, collision or paint repairs. Mobile Joe's RV Collision fixes them all. Brian James writes in, Lars, I got a text message from a coworker informing me the union was going on strike at midnight. Please don't kick my backside, I replied. He laughed. Why? Because I'm not a union member. I said it, meaning I don't support striking. I'm going to go to work if Weyerhaeuser lets me. When I showed up this morning at 3:15 a.m., there were seven guys standing in front of the gate with union on strike signs. I asked if I was allowed to go in and work. They said no. I've worked for Weyerhaeuser as a log truck driver for over 10 years. As far as I know, I'm the only employee who's not a union member. Whether I'm questioned on this matter, I explain to them the union puts most of its money behind the Democrat Party, a party that does not represent my values. They then usually point out the fact that I have to pay my dues. And I say, only because the law makes me do it. Signed, Brian James. Send those emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Get back to your phone calls and emails in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll if you like. It's on Twitter, at Lars Larson Show. And if you don't like Twitter, go to my website at LarsLarson.com. Now, I might have shared with you, when I was a kid, after my dad got out of the Navy, he became a forest ranger, and he worked for the U.S. Forest Service for quite a time. They used to grow trees and cut them and then replant them and things like that. These days, not so very much. But I remember he'd be out fighting fires for 2 or 3 days because when there was a fire, it was all hands on deck. And he'd come home and his clothes would stand up in the corner of the living room and smell like a campfire. But one of the things that is done sometimes when the conditions are right is you set a backfire. Because when it comes to a really big fire, you can't pour enough water on it to put it out unless Mother Nature does it with rain. So you have to deny the fire some fuel. Now, you can do that with chainsaws and hodads or Pulaskis and shovels, which is really hard. Or if you can burn the fuel away from the front edge of the fire, you can stop the fire right there. So the question is, how do you get those fires started? Well, they've used all kinds of low-tech, like drip torches loaded with kerosene and things like that. But these days, we've got fire bombs and drones. And the guy who is the engineer and the president of a company called Ignis, as in Ignite, is Jim Higgins, and he joins me now. Jim, thanks for taking a few minutes with me.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me about these drones and the firebombs they drop and how they can actually do some good.
Yeah, so the purpose of these is to carry what's called ignition spheres. It's about the size of a ping pong ball, and it contains one chemical. And the system we designed, it takes a needle, and it punches the side of the ignition sphere and ejects a second chemical, and then it drops the ball. And about 30 seconds later, it gets a point ignition source, you know, about like, a small flame that can light a small area on fire. So it can carry 450 of these ignition spheres, and you can light off a pretty significant area with that. And that's, you know, in a nutshell, pretty simple, but you do that over enough area, and you, like you said, you can deny a larger fire the fuel it needs to continue burning.
Yeah, because when you say put water on it, there just isn't enough water that you can put through pipes or hoses to be able to put a forest fire out or a wildfire. So this drone can, what, fly along a line guided by GPS and by somebody on the ground and drop a line of these little fireballs?
Yeah, exactly. So one of the other components we integrate into the system is a camera that has both a visual and a thermal camera. So in these really smoky conditions, you know, a visual image looks like a totally whited out screen. But the thermal camera actually allows you to see heat. So you can see the fire, you can see detail through the smoke. And it actually allows them to do this in the middle of the night. When it's pitch black out, the heat from the fire provides enough infrared light that they can use that thermal camera to actually continue operations through the middle of the night.
So are these drones being used all over the country now? I guess, depending on their need for them in situations like this?
Yeah, we actually have units, from Alaska to the tip of Florida, and we're actually international as well.
So when did you just sit down in your garage and come up with this? I don't want to diminish the engineering that went into this, but you're both the engineer and the head of the company. How'd you come up with this idea?
Yeah, well, I mean, so it was myself, and actually this was an idea born in a research lab at the University of Nebraska. I was a grad student at the time, and my two advisors there had sort of an interdepartmental meeting every semester with a few of the other professors. And one of the ecology professors said, hey, you know, it'd be really cool if you guys could use your drones to start fires. And sort of that was sort of the spark that led, you know, it was back in 2014. So we designed a number of these prototypes in the lab there at the university. And then we had enough people who caught wind of it and were interested and asked, you know, hey, where can we buy this? That the two professors and myself decided to launch out into a commercial company. And, you know, here we are 5 years later and hundreds of systems later out in the field.
Yeah. Not often that your college professor or your advisor comes to you and says, hey, we can figure out a technological way to start fires. But I'll tell you, Jim, my mom was born in Scottsbluff, Nebraska. That's, I think, on the western side of the state. I've been there before. There aren't any trees in Nebraska, yeah. Are there?
Once you get past, about the middle of the state, no. There's some scrubby grass, and that's about it.
But were they thinking about this for big fires that get started in those giant fields of wheat and corn and everything else, or were they thinking about places like the West?
You know, it's more applicable to places like the West. Here in the plains, it's really easy to use some of that lower tech stuff you talked about. You know, if you have a drip torch on an ATV, there's a road surrounding everywhere you want to burn. So typically in Nebraska, we don't get, you know, the big, super dangerous, raging fires. Just because of the terrain and the fuel that's here. Out west, where the terrain is really challenging, or down in the southeast, where, again, it's like swampy and super overgrown, that's where this technology really shines, because it allows people to stay out of the dangerous situations and use the technology to allow, you know, the same amount of resources to get more done.
I'm talking to Jim Higgins, who is president of Ignis and the head of engineering for DroneAmplified.com. So let me ask you this. I understand that any kid can walk into a store these days and buy a simple drone, but these sound complicated and expensive. Do you actually sell these to fire crews around the country, or do you say, we know how to run it, let us come out and do it for you and charge you?
No, we actually, our core strength is in engineering, computer science, and robotics. So we'll do some demonstrations, and we've gone out in the field a number of times with the end users just to kind of learn how they operate. But the Forest Service, the Department of Interior, National Park Service, they're all developing their own drone programs. So they are training pilots, and we help train people how to use the equipment. But at the end of the day, you know, they're the firefighters, and this is just another tool in their belt. So they are the ones actually doing the operation.
Any way to say how many of these things have been sold around the country?
Yeah, we're at about a couple hundred now.
And do you have any competition? Anybody else selling a competing firebomb-dropping drone?
To our knowledge, we're actually the only ones worldwide. There was one company in Australia a few years ago who said they were working on something, but we have not seen anything commercially available from them. So as far as we know, we're the only game in the world.
What is one of these things, what does the whole outfit cost to buy the remote control and the drone? And I guess you supply the firebombs, or do they have to buy those somewhere else?
No. So actually what we did is it's already a commercially available product that they had been dropping out of helicopters for years and years. So they're actually cached at the various equipment like depots around the country. We purposefully went with that product because they know it. They have tons of them available to them. So that was, sort of lowered the bar of entry to get this out in people's hands. They already had the consumable product readily available to them.
Anything else people want to know about these things? And I assume you don't sell them to the general public.
No, I mean, we get this question a lot of, this could be used for nefarious purposes. And I tell people there is so much easier and cheaper ways if you want to do harm than doing all the training and the cost and the effort it takes to use one of these. But once you know how to use it, it's an amazing tool for doing good.
And I would assume that you're a little choosy when it comes to customers. I don't just call you up and say, here's my Visa card or my debit card. I'd like to have you send one to this address. You check out the buyers.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the bulk of our product goes to the national, either the Forest Service or the Department of Interior. And then there are some state groups who have them. And there's a couple of contractors who do, ecology management. They do some prescribed burning for hire. The bulk of it is the federal government who we sell to.
Very good. Jim, thanks very much. And congrats on being the only game in town when it comes to firebomb dropping drones.
Thanks so much.
You betcha. That's Jim Higgins, who is president of Ignis and the head of engineering at DroneAmplified.com. We'll be back in just a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
There's something happening here. Got a breast with a brain that's not clear. He's got bloods where there used to be hair. Shaking hands when nobody's there. Think it's time to stop. Hey, what's that sound? Biden's Democrats are going down. The left is in disarray. November 8th could be a red day. We should win big, but we must beware. Voter fraud could occur everywhere. Time to stop. Hey, what's that sound? Democrats keep losing ground. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Their policies will be unwound. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Run them out of D.C. town.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. That is our great parody guy, the great Jim Gossett. And this is the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. I want to grab some of your phone calls. A lot of you want to sound off on some of the things we've talked about already. I'd like all of you to sound off on our Twitter poll. The question, should all negotiations over government employee contracts be done in public? Now, lately, we've been hearing a lot about a lot of teacher strikes, either threatened strikes or strikes that have actually begun. It sounds like Seattle has now settled its teacher strike. But you know who are the only folks who don't know the details? I mean, the union knows the details. The union members, the teachers know the details. The school board knows the details. And all the public employees who are employed as government employees allegedly serving you know the details. You know who the folks who are cut out of that equation in knowing what deal is being signed? Why, the folks that are writing the check. The taxpayers, in that case, of the city of Seattle. But in every case, when public employees negotiate, and the only people who don't know what's going on are the people paying the bill, I think that's wrong. Our Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show on Twitter and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. To your calls now. Let's start with John. Hey, John, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, thanks for taking the call.
You bet.
I've been in the timber industry for 35-plus years, and going back to your talking about, you know, why they don't get on fires and get them put out right away. To be honest, it's all about money. I've got family who is in the firefighting end of it as well, and they spend most of their time quibbling about whose responsibility is, which that means who's going to pay the bill. And if we wait long enough, we get federal money to come in.
Yep.
So I agree totally with your premise that we need to get on it. Absolutely. The fires 2 years ago was the exact same thing. They sat there and burned for a month or two, smoldering, and, oh, this is in a wilderness area, so we can't touch it. They didn't have to touch it. They could have dropped water on it or retardant or something and never touched it. So it's
imagine Cedar Creek fire. Imagine the Cedar Creek fire identified, you know, so detected on the 1st of August. And here we are very, very close to the middle of September, a month and a half later. And now it's blown up into a gigantic fire. And everybody says, oh, that's very sad that thousands of people have been put at or their buildings, at least, have been put at risk, lives potentially at risk as well. But my question is, just like it was with the Chetco Bar fire a couple of years ago, just about every year there's at least one fire where you say, when did you first detect this fire? Oh, month ago, month and a half ago. Well, why didn't you put it out? Well, we figured it'd go out on its own, or it was on the other side of a political boundary or something. To me, they're all cockamamie excuses. And, John, I've used this excuse. I get along very well with my next-door neighbor, Chiwu Chang, and I've done things for him. He's done things for me. If his house catches fire, do I have a legal authority to go onto his property? And the answer is no. Would I, in the case of a fire? Yeah. Do I have the legal authority to, I'd call the fire department. I can do that. But if they said, if you thought he was inside, would you bust the door? I'd say, yeah, I'd bust the door. I'd bust a window, whatever I had to do. Do you have legal authority to do that? No. Do I care?
Right.
If I, you know, and if his house is empty, I know he's gone for a while. Sometimes he's had me keep an eye on his house. I'd say your house caught fire and it appeared to be in your living room. So I busted the window and brought a garden hose in and put water on it. If somebody was dumb enough to say, well, did you have the legal authority to break into his house and use his garden hose? I wouldn't even answer a question like that. But unfortunately, we've got people in government who seem to think that way all the time. So a fire going for almost a month and a half, and now it's blown up into a major problem. Let's go to Wayne in Grants Pass. Hey, Wayne, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network.
Welcome. Thank you, sir. What a great honor and privilege it is to speak to a great orator for 2 decades like you, sir.
You're too kind. What's on your mind today?
Yes, sir. All the rant and rave about the homeless population. Disabled in America own a 1990 federal law to an apartment called the 1990 American Disability Act. If you are physically or mentally impaired, you can apply a claim to Social Security. If they have to take steps to prove it that you're disabled, you will get a benefit check. That benefit check depends on your hours, I mean your credits during your work history. I own 160 employers on my work record from 1990 to 2008.
Wayne, you're going to have to finish it up fast or we're going to hit the break.
Real quick. Why is the state neglecting these humans and putting these illegals and foreigners into an apartment?
Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits, at least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's that's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. I'll get to your phone calls and emails here in just a moment. But I've got with me on the phone the person who, if there is any justice in the world, will be the next governor of the state of Oregon and the first Republican governor in more than a third of a century. Christine Drazen is the GOP nominee. Christine, welcome back to the program. And how's the campaign going?
Well, the campaign is going really well, Lars, and thank you for your endorsement. You know, Republicans, conservatives, people across our state that want change are uniting, and that's the only way we're going to get this done.
You know, I want to ask you about a bunch of different issues. Let's start with the CAT tax, this billion-dollar tax that is effectively a sales tax in a state that's notorious for hating sales taxes. You didn't vote for that, did you?
No, I voted no because it was a terrible idea, a terrible decision. And Oregonians had repeatedly said no on that issue. But, you know, my opponents, they both voted yes. And that increased taxes across our state, $2 billion every 2 years comes into state coffers because of that vote. And Oregonians pay every penny of that passed on down to consumers.
I just said a billion because I tend to go in annual numbers because most of the rest of the world does. Government does things differently. What could you do short of the legislature revoking that tax? What could you do to shut it down? Is there anything?
We need to pressure the legislature. It's in Oregon statute. They need to work with me to repeal that tax and roll it back. We have right now substantial reserves. Our state has never seen revenues at the levels that we have now. And we need to support jobs. We need to support businesses across our state.
I want to ask you about crime, because you've said that law and order and crime is one of your hallmarks of your campaign. And yet critics say, but you voted to really do some serious damage to Measure 11 and I think it was SB 1008. Those were damaging to Oregon, but you weren't there for some of the votes. Is that right?
I was serving my constituents. You know, Tina Kotek got the votes and she called the session and rammed that bill through. I would have been there to proudly vote no against that legislation if I were not meeting with my constituents and holding a constituent event that evening. There was absolutely offended by the nature of that vote and the fact that they wanted to roll back Measure 11.
But your opponent has made an issue of this. Would it have made a difference? Would it have stopped the bill if you had been there to vote no?
No, it would not have stopped the bill. But here's what we know. My opponents don't have anything to run on. They have failed records. They have terrible voting records. And the proof is in the pudding. We know our state is worse off today than it was a decade ago. So a decade of single-party control, that's Tina Kotek, that's Betsy Johnson. They are failed leaders and certainly career politicians that should not be given this opportunity to lead. So what are they going to do? They're going to make up stuff. And we should expect no differently from them.
I'm talking to Christine Drazen. She's the GOP nominee to be Oregon's first Republican governor in more than 34 years. You can find her at Christine4OregonOregon.com, right? Let me ask you about a couple of other. I got an incredible amount of grief from people saying, no, the only way to take Oregon back, and I'm hearing this from more establishment and what I would consider rhino Republicans saying, you have to go for Betsy Johnson. Now, I've known Betsy Johnson a long time. I would consider her even an acquaintance or a friend. But I don't vote for people because I'm their friends. I also don't vote for people who are perfect candidates because I have yet to find the perfect candidate. I've told you, I don't think you're the perfect candidate, but you're pro-life. And you're in favor of going after the crime problems this state has. And yet a lot of the establishment seems to want to have either Tina Kotek or Betsy Johnson. How would you answer that?
They're determined to lose. And they are determined from the beginning to give up on the future of our state. The only way we're going to get this done is if we join together and we choose to win. We have got to lead our state in a new direction by choosing to stand together, shoulder to shoulder, arm in arm, and win together. The Democrats want us to split apart. The Democrats want us to look at Betsy Johnson and believe this fabricated story about what her history is. She's a 20-plus year Democrat in the state legislature. She is pro-choice, and she has nothing in common with Republican values. And so anybody that's considering her is being fooled. She is absolutely there to manipulate and mislead.
See, I think the same thing, and I've had people say, but Lars, why is this issue so important? Well, the Supreme Court threw the whole question of abortion and the right to life back to the states in June of this year. I said, how can I very well call myself pro-life, and I am, if I then vote for one of the two pro-abortion candidates, Betsy Johnson or Tina Kotek, when I have the opportunity to vote for a pro-life candidate, you? And they've said, well, you voted for pro-choice before. I said, when they're the only ones on the menu, and Newt Bueller was the choice of Republicans in Oregon a few years ago, he was pro-abortion. I didn't like it, but it was that or vote for the Democrat who was abortion all the way to the moment of birth. I mean, in other words, a more extreme view of abortion. And in past years, I've even said, well, it isn't really a state issue right now because the states don't have much that they can do about it. But now the states do. I'd be a fool to go otherwise. And I've told people that. And they said, well, then you're going to lose. I said, I don't care if I lose. I mean, I'd rather win, but I'm not going to vote for somebody just to say I voted for a winner, even though I had to violate some of my core beliefs. Let me ask you about fires. And one issue in particular that's dogged me for years. We have fires in the Pacific Northwest that are allowed to burn for weeks or even months before a serious effort is made to put them out. There's one going right now, the Cedar Creek fire, which was identified on the 1st of August and blew up in about the last week. But they let it burn for more than a month. Now, I want a commitment from you. If you become the governor of Oregon, will you go out and put fire, tell the people who work for the state to put the fire out and ignore the political boundaries?
Yeah, we have to suppress fires. And in the case of this, of the Cedar Creek fire, the governor had the opportunity all the way back to your point from August to push and push and demand that the feds put that fire out. And if they wouldn't put the fire out, to do what she could to address that issue. They saw
But I want a firm commitment, not just do what she could, because she can always say, I don't have the legal authority to do it. I want to know, would you as governor say, I'm not going to let thousands of homes, which are currently at risk right now, thousands of homes and businesses be put at risk. If the feds won't do it, we will cross that line and get the job done.
Lars, if the feds won't do it, I will always stand up for Oregonians. I think there's a way to do this without doing something illegal. So what we have right now, though, is failed leadership. She has not done everything she could do. And I think we have to start there. I don't think we need nuclear war with the feds, with the Forest Service, but we need to force this issue and we need to force accountability from them. They can't continue to put Oregonians at risk.
Well, I think I'd get maybe the same answer from Johnson. I have to say that, but Christine, good luck to you. Christine for Oregon.com. I want her to say it doesn't matter. When it comes to lives and safety and businesses and people's homes, and a political boundary with the federal government, the political boundary comes second. People's lives and homes come first. We'll be back in a moment.
You know, we also were able to make it cheaper to get an electric vehicle if you want to save money on gas.
That is the Transportation Secretary of the United States, Pete Buttigieg, and this is the Lars Larson Show. Welcome to the best conversation in talk journalism at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And of course, naysayers always go to the head of the line. And I'm going to be a naysayer on what Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, who wasn't even a good small town mayor in the state of Indiana. He wasn't. He couldn't even keep the roads paved, didn't get along well with the cops, but now he's running the transportation sector for the United States of America. Welcome to the Radio Northwest Network as well. Glad to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 and a half years. Pete Buttigieg was a failure as a small-town mayor, and now he's failed upward, as so many do in the Biden administration. He's now transportation secretary, and he says, well, we've made it cheaper for you to be able to buy an electric car. That's right. If $4 gas or $5 gas or wherever it goes back to, it's gone down a little bit, but it's certainly way up from where it was when Joe Biden took over in January of last year, a nationwide average of $2.39 a gallon. It topped $5 and has now dropped back a bit, and Joe Biden wants to brag on that. But here's Pete Buttigieg saying, well, we made it cheaper. Yes, the average electric vehicle, the average, is $67,000. And the federal government says, well, we'll give you a $7,500 rebate to buy a new one, but it has to be made in America. And that is a tiny number of all the electric cars. Most of them are not getting final assembly in the United States, which means most of them won't qualify. And if the idea of spending $67,000 or take off the federal subsidy, take it down to $60,000, if that's an attractive way to save on because you're upset about paying $5 for gasoline. I saw this piece, though, by a guy I admire greatly. We haven't had him on the show in a long time, too long. His name is Bjorn Lomborg. And he's a guy who has studied climate science and all these other issues and actually has kind of a sensible point of view. Now, one of the things he points out is that when you want to try to sell electric vehicles to Americans and say, we have to do this to protect the environment, he writes, electric cars' impact on air pollution is not as straightforward as you might think. The vehicles themselves, get this, pollute only slightly less than a gasoline car because their massive batteries and the consequent weight of the car leads to more particulate pollution from greater wear on brakes, tires, and road. You'd forgotten that that's part of pollution. It's not just what comes out the tailpipe. He says, on top of that, the additional electricity they require can throw large amounts of air pollution, depending on how it's generated. One recent study found that electric cars put out more of the most dangerous particulate air pollution than gasoline-powered cars in 70% of U.S. states. The American Economic Association found that rather than lowering air pollution, on average, each additional electric car in the U.S. causes additional air pollution damage worth about $1,100 over its lifetime. And then he talks about what goes into the batteries. He says the minerals required for these batteries present an ethical problem. Many are mined in areas with dismal human rights records. Cobalt, and I've mentioned cobalt and its role in electric cars, it's dug in Congo, where child labor is not uncommon, specifically when it comes to mining. And there are security risks as well, given that the mineral processing is concentrated where else? Joe Biden's favorite country, communist China. He writes that increasing demand for already prized materials is likely to drive up the price of electric cars significantly. So if people start buying them, because states like California, Oregon, Washington, 16 others have said you have to buy them. We're not going to let you buy gas or diesel cars anymore. They said to reach net zero by 2050, the annual demand for lithium for automobile batteries that year alone would be almost 28 times as much as the current annual production of lithium. You're going to have to increase the lithium supply 28-fold to be able to meet demands to reach net zero by 2050. The material prices for batteries this year are three times what they were in 2021. And by the way, he points out that electricity is not getting cheaper either. This is all Bjorn Lomborg. He's written some great books, The Skeptical Environmentalist and others. He says proponents argue, though, even though they're more expensive to buy, electric cars are cheaper to drive. But a new report from the U.S. Energy Department lab, and that's, by the way, Joe Biden's U.S. Energy Department, found that even in 2025, the default electric car's total lifetime cost will be 9% higher than a gasoline car. So in other words, if you think you're saving money, you aren't over the long term. And he says, in part, this is because electric cars are a luxury item. Two-thirds of the households in the U.S. that own one have incomes over $100,000 a year. For 9 out of 10 electric vehicle-owning households, it's only a second car. They also have a gasoline-powered car, like a pickup truck or an SUV or a minivan that they use for longer trips because the electric car doesn't have enough range. And then when you say, but well, Europe is using them, he points out, yes, they are. But that's why electric cars still require massive subsidies. Norway is the only country where most new cars sold are electric. And you know how they did that? They wiped out the entire sales and registration tax for a vehicle. That's $25,000 per car. By wiping that out, they got the number of cars sold to be more than 50%. Even with that, only 12.5% of all Norwegian cars on the road right now are electric. The country, by the way, and a bit ironically, has the wealth to pay to give all these subsidies to buy electric cars. Why? Because Norway is flush with cash. Well, gosh, Lars, where do they make that money? Well, a big part of it comes from oil revenue. Now, the trade is kind of dubious, he says. He does the math. To cut 1 ton of CO2 emissions through subsidizing electric cars, Norway has to sell 100 barrels of oil, which emit 40 tons of CO2. You get that equation? You sell 100 barrels of oil, that will put 40 tons of CO2 in the air, and by doing that, you can subsidize electric cars to cut 1 ton of CO2. Obviously, he says other countries' car stocks are not going to be anywhere close to 100% electric. The U.S. Energy Information Administration, a federal agency of the Biden administration, estimates that without new legislation, only about 17% of all new U.S. cars will be electric by 2050. That totals to about 13% of all the cars on the road. So the math doesn't add up. He says as consumers continue to vote with their wallets against electric cars, it's hard to imagine places like California continuing to demand that they only buy the electric ones. But that is exactly what California is doing. They're saying, you have to do it. And then we have other nitwit states that have said, oh, if California is doing it, it must be the cool new thing to do. So we'll make all of our citizens do it as well. You know what this is going to do short run? California and all the other states that have followed it have said, we have to have all electric cars by 2035. You say, well, that's 12.5 years from now. I'm not going to worry about it now. What they're going to do is cut the percentage of gasoline and diesel cars by 30% in the next 2.5 years. Do you know what happens, or have you learned what happens over the last 2 years when you cut the supply of anything, whether it's plywood or gasoline? The price goes through the roof. So what they're going to do is make gasoline and diesel cars hugely expensive by telling the car companies, don't make these. And if you want to buy one of them, you're going to pay through the nose. Or you can buy one of the electric cars that, again, are not going to save the planet, and they require massive subsidies from the federal government. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. It's the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. Email talk at LarsLarson.com. And, of course, you can vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and on my website as well. Like any homeowner who's been a homeowner for a long time, I've got tools, I've got ladders, things like that. And in some ways, I get kind of a kick out of the fact that you read the warning labels. I mean, I think the average ladder you buy these days has about 50 different stickers on it that are all mandated by the lawyers who work for the ladder company, because they have to say, don't stand on the top step. And a lot of them just come off as stupid because you read them and to say, well, nobody would do something like that. Well, clearly the lawyers think somebody out there might do something stupid with that product. So they have to put a label on it saying, we told them not to do it. But what happens, and should a company be held liable, when parents look at the warning label on a product that they bought and then use the product, in this case involving an infant child, and then something bad happens? Do you hold the company liable when the parents ignore the warning labels? Oliver Dunford joins me now, who's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Oliver, welcome back to the program. And can we describe the case in point that you're talking about in this example?
Yeah, thanks, Lars, for having me again. Yeah, we represent a company called Leach Co. It's a small family business in Ada, Oklahoma. They make a number of products, including an infant lounger in which parents can use to place their baby while they're folding laundry or something like that. The product comes with express warnings that says, do not use for sleep, and an adult must always be supervising. And yet, in this case, as you said, there were two incidents, but it had nothing to do with the product. It was because people ignored those instructions. In one case, a daycare center violated state law, ignored the warnings, and left the baby unattended for over an hour and a half, and the baby unfortunately died. In another case, a parent was sharing a bed with a baby, which is also warned against, and in the middle of the night rolled over and suffocated the baby. And so based on those two incidents alone, the Consumer Product Safety Commission says that this product is defective, even though they've sold 180,000 of these things, and the defect under the commission's own definitions is something that creates a substantial risk of injury. So under any scenario, it's almost impossible to hold the company liable here.
So this isn't just the courts and lawyers, because I can understand. I've lost adults in my family. We haven't had the loss of a child, but I can't imagine the pain that comes with it. But if you're the person responsible, either the daycare center or in the case of the parent who rolls over on a child, which I've heard of before, we were very careful with my granddaughter when she was a little baby to make sure that everybody made sure you set them up in a physical situation where you can't possibly roll over and smother a baby. I know that parent wants to find somebody else made this happen, and they want to blame somebody else. But should the government, in the form of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, be piling on and saying, you're right, it's not the parent's fault for rolling over on the baby, it's these folks in Ada, Oklahoma that made this defective device. Should the government be weighing in that way at all?
Well, we don't think so. And there's not only is there a problem with the theory that they're claiming, but there's also a problem with the procedure. Traditionally, to hold someone liable for a defect in a product means that it had to be designed wrong or made wrong or the warnings were insufficient. But none of that applies here. And so the government has this theory that it is reasonably foreseeable that parents or other people will ignore the warnings, and therefore the company should be liable. But, and that's a novel theory which would expand liability dramatically. The other problem is that the commission here is not going to court. Instead, it filed an administrative action before itself. So the commission is made up of five commissioners. They voted to approve the administrative action. Then the commission staff has to prove its case to a commission-appointed administrative law judge. And then if there's an appeal, it goes right back to the commissioners.
So it's a done deal at this point, because the commission will undoubtedly support its own ruling in this case. And I guess, let me go back to something else. I know that sometimes the law isn't always logical, but isn't there a logical contradiction if an agency says this was reasonably foreseeable by a parent, by a layperson, but we, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, did not foresee this outcome? Because they could have said at the beginning, we're not going to give approval for this because we could foresee the danger. I mean, if you have a plastic bag, and all plastic bags have little warnings on them saying, you know, don't put this over anybody's head, let alone a child's head, because you could reasonably foresee that putting a plastic bag over somebody's head might suffocate them. The Consumer Product Safety Commission didn't foresee this outcome, but then they're going to fault the manufacturer for not foreseeing what the Consumer Product Safety Commission itself didn't foresee?
Well, and the bigger problem, I think, is that what wouldn't this apply to? Everything can pose some danger if used improperly. And again, take this pillow, this lounging pillow. They've sold 180,000 of them. And if you assume that each pillow was used only once, which is unreasonable because parents undoubtedly use them multiple times, but if they were used only once and there were two injuries here, that amounts to an injury rate of 1/1,000th of a percent. And so if that is enough to create a substantial risk of injury, then I'm not sure what the Consumer Product Safety Commission couldn't try to recall.
Well, and that gets to the next question I wanted to ask you. This doesn't just affect this company called Leachco, which is in Ada, Oklahoma. It actually affects everybody who makes any kind of infant product, and I assume it could go beyond that, because I could foresee, that the screwdriver in my toolbox could be used to assault somebody or stab somebody, or I could stab myself in the eye with it, which is something I'm always aware of when I'm using screwdrivers and, you know, punches and things like that, which is why I wear safety glasses. But are you going to make all those companies say anytime something bad happens because somebody could imagine it happening, that the company is to blame for this?
Well, and the answer is, who knows? The commission has a regulation. It says that there are many factors it considers, and it doesn't mention a screwdriver, but it does mention a knife. And it says that a knife has a sharp blade, but it needs to be sharp in order to work properly. And so in that instance, the benefit outweighs the potential harm. But then it lists all these things, and among the considerations are whether the product at issue is necessary and whether it's useful. And of course, the question is, well, necessary and useful to whom? And apparently the answer is that the commissioners, in their wisdom. And then it also says they can consider any other relevant factor, which means any other factor that they deem relevant. And so it's a completely arbitrary process on what they consider necessary and useful, and whether in their estimation the benefits of a product outweigh the harm.
Okay, I'm talking to Oliver Dunford. He's an attorney with Pacific Legal, and I admire Pacific Legal. But tell me this. So if the Consumer Product Safety Commission can issue this ruling, and then if anybody appeals it, it comes right back to CPSC, is there any appeal beyond that where you can go to some other body and say, by the way, tell the Consumer Product Safety Commission they're being ridiculous?
Yes, there is. At the end of that process, you are allowed to appeal to a real court. But in that case, the courts have to treat the factual record as found by the commission, and they often defer to the agency's legal rulings. So in effect, it's just as long as there wasn't a huge problem with what the commission did, as long as there's some evidence to support what it did, we're going to approve it. And so by that time, you really don't get a judicial review. You get kind of a mostly a rubber stamp. So we sued in federal court to stop the commission's administrative proceeding. And one of our arguments is that our client has a due process right to a court, to a trial before a judge and a jury. And if the commission has a case, it can prove it there.
Yeah, absolutely right. Oliver, thank you very much. That's Oliver Dunford from Pacific Legal Foundation. We'll be back in a moment. 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Northwest in the three states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, for the past 22 and a half years. And this segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles. You pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Our Twitter poll today: should all negotiations over government employee contracts be done in public? That sounds a little bureaucratic, but all it means is when you hear that, say, the Seattle Education Association, which went on strike illegally, teachers denied kids their first few days in school. Now it looks like they have a deal. And if you say, well, what are the details of the deal? Well, you're not allowed to know. The only folks who are allowed to know are the education establishment, education officials like superintendents and school boards. How about us, the public? How about the folks who are paying the bill? No, you don't have any right to know. Well, our friend Jason Mercier at the Washington Policy Center says, hey, you ought to make sure that all government employee unions and their negotiations be conducted in public. The public has a right to know. And if you're told, well, you'll find out what the deal was after we've signed it. You mean after it's already a done deal, the public can find out what it's actually going to cost them or what the terms of the contract are? No, if we're paying the bill, we have a right to know what's going on in the deal before the deal is a done deal. Today's Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to Steve in Gig Harbor. Steve, thanks for listening on KVI and the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Lars. I have a couple of questions. The first one I want to ask is, what country in the world is running 90% of their cars on something other than gasoline since the mid-1980s?
I can't. It's a trivia question. I don't know the answer. What's the answer?
Brazil. They've been running their cars on alcohol all that time. It's a small business model and quite a bit cheaper than gasoline.
And do you know why it's cheaper there? It's an artificially cheap fuel because, correct me if I'm wrong, they make it from sugar. Brazil creates a huge amount of sugar. They have huge sugar crops, and they benefit from American, I think it's price controls that effectively double the cost of sugar here. That's supposed to protect the five families that own most of the sugar business in America. I think all five of them are in Florida. I could be wrong about that. And that by jacking up the prices that actually helps Brazil. So they have an excess of sugar, both for export and other purposes, and they turn into fuel. But is it actually grown and sold at market cost and turned into ethanol?
I believe it is. I don't know the details. There's a guy named David Blum that has a book that's called Alcohol Can Be a Gas Too. Back during the 20s, or, you know, when we had Prohibition, Rockefeller funded the Woman's Christian Group with $6 million and shut down alcohol. Well, alcohol was a competing fuel then because all the Model A's used to run on alcohol. They had a knob on the dash, so if you ran into the city and you didn't have alcohol, you would, and it was a byproduct from our crops. I think it's something that we can do. And
here's the question I'd have for you. Right now, ethanol is not cost competitive. The reason, and I can tell you how I know it's not cost competitive, because if it were cost competitive to grow and produce sugar, usually corn or other things like that, they've always talked about trying to make wood mass into alcohol because we have lots of wood mass here. The problem is it's more expensive than gasoline, or it's at least it's not cost competitive. If it were, everybody in the country would say, well, let's make pure ethanol fuel or mostly ethanol fuel because it's cheaper than buying oil. But the problem is, will it be cheaper in the United States? And I think that the short answer is no. And you say, well, then buy it from Brazil. I think there may be some reasons we can't do that either. Because if you're not thinking it's going to be cheaper here, then how does that advantage us?
Well, one thing is diesel engines, if you run it, the byproduct is water coming out of your exhaust, and it's the particulates that wear your engine down. You tear down a diesel engine after 500,000 miles, and it still looks new. If you're running straight alcohol, just not ethanol 10%, but straight alcohol. And it's legal to grow, you can do 2.5 acres worth on your own property. You can do up to 2,500 gallons a year from your own property. That could be enough for an entire neighborhood. But it's a small business model.
By the way, you are aware that a gallon, I do know this, when they say, well, we're going to put 10% alcohol in your fuel, alcohol by gallon is about 2/3 the energy of a gallon of gasoline. So it's a ripoff of the American consumer, because they say, well, how does that work? And I say, well, if you buy 100 gallons of what we call gasoline in America, then 10 gallons of it is ethanol. Except the 10 gallons of ethanol only has the energy capacity of 6 gallons of gasoline. So it really means when you buy 100 gallons of gas in America, you're really getting 96 gallons, if I'm doing the math right, 96 gallons of gasoline. But you're getting charged for 100, and the government collects taxes on 100, but you're only getting 96. It's like going to a bad butcher shop and having the butcher put his thumb on the scale. So everything seems to be a little bit more expensive, but it's artificial. But I'd be okay with that. Although the last story I just saw, election time Brazil gasoline tax cut leads mills to shun ethanol. What's happening is the mills that make all that sugar, the government has cut the tax on gasoline, and as a result, it's apparently curbed the profit margins of the mills. So they're saying, oh, if you're going to curb our margin on making ethanol, then we won't make as much ethanol. We'll just sell it to the rest of the world as sugar. It's when the government gets involved, things get screwed up. And you've got the Lars Larson Show.
Oregon Utility Notification Center wants to remind you that whether you're planting a tree, building a fence, or just making improvements around your farm or home, click or call before you start your work to get the area marked. Then dig safely and avoid contact with buried utilities. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones. Know what's below. Call before you dig. For more information, visit us online at digsafelyoregon.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I'll do that in just a minute at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show on Twitter and at LarsLarson.com on the web. Now, I mentioned this story last week about the fact that kids riding public transit in places like Seattle and Tacoma are going to be subsidized, apparently to the tune of 100%. And I thought I'd ask Senator Mark Schessler about that. He is a Washington State Senator representing District 9, and he is a member of the Republican Party. We haven't had Democrats on in a while, although they are always invited. Senator, welcome back.
Great to be with you again, Lars.
So why are taxpayers in rural Washington expected to pay for the bus rides of kids in Seattle and Tacoma?
Where else is Jay Inslee going to buy votes?
Yeah, well, that's a very good point, because the kids out in the rural areas are sensible.
The bluer the area, the more free stuff, the more projects you saw in the last session. It's not about Klickitat County. It's not about Wakayakum County. It's about what's good for really blue areas, and that's a lot of free stuff. In the same update from the governor's office, he proudly mentioned four counties with major projects for preserving our highways. They were all I-5 corridor, north of Vancouver, of course.
North of Vancouver. So Clark County is not getting a piece of that where I live?
No, this was, look, all we're doing in King, Snohomish, Whatcom, none of the areas that your listeners tend to congregate in see the big projects, but he's very proud of the four counties that he carried that they get the pork. And their kids travel for free. Our kids pay the bill and their parents.
And by the way, just so people know just how full subsidy this is, this says that every single person age 18 or younger, so this will include adults who are 18 but not 19 yet, gets free zero fare ridership on public transit and state ferries as well in some parts of the state for anybody 18 and younger. And is this supposed to somehow address a burning need to allow kids to get to school or something like that? Because it doesn't sound like it's just limited to the school year or to school hours. It just says kids can travel out around free of charge on public transit. Is that a good understanding of it?
Well, the publicly, it's we're going to teach them to fight climate change by using public transit. It also creates an entitlement mentality for a lot of voters. But the dollars are probably worse. Instead of trying to buy beer before you're 21, you're going to be 21 and wanting to get a free ferry ride or a free bus ride. I guarantee you they're not going to ID every kid that looks a little bit old to let them get on a bus, let them get on a ferry. So it's probably going to cost even more.
I also suspect something else, Senator, and I pointed this out over the last probably decade or so, that all public transit in the Northwest has seen declining ridership, especially if you factor in per capita ridership, meaning as the population gets bigger, you would expect the transit ridership to get bigger. But when you factor in per capita ridership, it's actually been declining even as billions of dollars have been poured into it. And I know that Seattle's metro system, the bus system, has said we're not generating enough ridership and we need to somehow get those numbers up. It sounds like Jay Inslee may have just handed them a solution. You're going to have a whole bunch of people riding it for nothing.
Clearly a big subsidy, because you can go to my region, Ben Franklin Transit. They have $125, $150 million in reserve, empty buses, and Commissioner Clint Didier just told me recently they realized that they had management people living in Seattle that really weren't necessary because they'd never showed up in the Tri-Cities anyway, so they let them go. That's what I call a good start.
Well, and the thing I've also tried to impress people with is they say, well, how much of the cost of buses is paid for by the riders? I said, almost nothing. And they said, what do you mean? I said, well, if you just take the operations cost, meaning the fuel, whether it's electricity or natural gas or gasoline or diesel, or in the case of light rail trains, electricity, and the cost of the driver and the cost of maintenance and everything else, the fare box, last time I checked, produces maybe 20% of that. So the riders are only paying 20% of operations costs and zero of the capital costs, which are in the billions and billions of dollars. You're getting this smoking good deal already, even if you have to pay a bit to ride a bus or buy a monthly pass. they're already getting a good deal and that's not good enough, so now we have to drop the cost for those riders to zero?
Well, this is socialism in the name of climate change, because at the end of the day, you're creating a new class of dependency, and unfortunately, every other family in the state has to maintain their automobile, whether it's a $2,500 junker or an $80,000 EV. They have to maintain their vehicle themselves. They have to pay license, insurance, fuel, electricity, whatnot. This is a clear bait and switch.
Is there any way to shut this down at the next legislative session to say this makes no sense? These kids, if they need to go somewhere, if they need to go to a job, if they need to go to school, they're already getting a very, very good deal right now. And there's no need to subsidize it further, nor to subsidize. If you want to subsidize it, fine. Put the entire cost of the subsidy on the counties that actually get the benefit.
Well, I think the one thing that would probably make the most sense and allow local control is demand a minimum percentage of the cost of operations to come from ridership. Let them decide how they're going to get there, but you got to raise that level to, say, 50 or 60% minimum.
Yep.
And we'll let you decide how to do it, whether you're going to charge young adults to ride the buses, whether you're going to actually raise the cost. But we need to get the cost of operation back to being the majority of the cost.
I think a lot of people, Senator Schessler, don't realize that, you know, when you pay the gasoline and diesel taxes at the pump, the federal piece of it, about 40% of that goes to mass transit, and only about 60% of it goes to actually build freeways and highways and that sort of thing out of the federal part of that tax. So when you say, well, where are they going to get the money? Well, they're getting a lot of your money already from people who don't ride, may never ride transit at all, but they're paying 40% of federal gas tax, gas and diesel taxes into this system. It's not reasonable, and it is reasonable to say the riders should pay half of the operations costs anyway.
Well, I think a minimum percentage, knowing that a well-run system does help reduce congestion, air quality, but for crying out loud, is it too much to ask you to pay half of the cost of getting to work or getting to where you want to recreate? I don't
think so either. Senator Mark Schessler from District 9, he is in the Washington legislature, and it's a pleasure to have him on. Back in just a moment, should we trust a government agency like CDC that now it admits it lied to the public about the vax testing? We'll get to that. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. As we always like to say, naysayers go to the head of the line, and they have for 25 years. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, you're always welcome. And if you disagree with the host of the show, yours truly, I'd be glad to put you right to the head of the line. All my producers know that. Just dial me up at 866-439-5277. You can send emails, get a lot of naysayer emails that way. talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Either way, you can do it. The vote counts the same. I want to talk about vaccines for a moment, and I want to talk about something that has just come to light because of some very good work, I think, by the Epoch Times. They went after the CDC, and the CDC has led a lot of Americans to distrust that federal agency. In fact, I would argue that the CDC has caused a lot of mistrust, not just in government agencies, but also in medicine in general. But this story about the false information they gave, because going all the way back to the fall of 2020, when we knew that a vaccine or vaccines were on the way for COVID. And the question became, will people have the choice to take the vaccine or not? And we found out that a lot of government agencies, including Joe Biden's federal government, took the view that Americans could be forced to do this. And state agencies did the same kind of thing, and local governments as well around America. And then you had private companies that followed them. Now, there were a few private companies that said, this is crazy. We're going to lose some of the best trained people that we have who are working for us if we tell them it's either the vaccine or you lose your job. It's your choice, but that's really not much of a choice. So some of the questions that were asked were, are you testing these vaccines? And not just testing them before they're sent out to be used on people, but are you actually keeping an eye on adverse effects of the vaccines. And I've told you about any number of cases involving young athletes who just mysteriously drop dead of mysterious heart ailments. And that number seems to have gone up dramatically. And it does seem to be tied to getting vaccinated. And then you said, well, what about the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System? It's known as VAERS. And it's not mandatory. But if your doctor, for example, gives you a vaccine and you have an adverse effect, an allergic reaction, or you just drop dead, then the doctor can but is not required to report it. Well, the question is, was CDC paying attention to this? Here's what Epoch Times just broke today. The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, you've heard her name before, has now acknowledged publicly for the first time that the agency gave false information about its COVID-19 vaccine safety monitoring. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the agency's director, said in a letter that was only made public yesterday that the CDC did not analyze certain types of adverse event reports in all of last year. Now, that's pretty stunning because CDC had said, well, we're keeping an eye on it. There's vaccine adverse event reporting, and we're watching it. They had previously said they started watching the effects in February of 21, which kind of makes sense because if you remember, the very first vaccines were deployed around America in the middle of December of 2020, about a month and a half after the election. And then Joe Biden actually got his first shot in December. Then he got a second shot in January. And then he was made president. He took the oath of office on the 20th of January of last year. And since then, Joe Biden has lied. He said there was no vaccine when he arrived at the White House. There was. There had already been millions of Americans who decided to take the vaccine. And there were a lot more Americans who are taking it under threat that if they didn't take it, they'd lose their jobs and maybe even lose their license as a doctor, as a nurse. There were airline pilots that got fired or ended up taking the vaccine, and some of them had adverse effects that actually pushed them out of the business altogether. There was one airline pilot who landed his plane. He was going, I think, Dallas to Denver or vice versa. He pulled up the gate and had a heart attack, went to the doctor, and they said, well, you appear to have a heart condition that was caused by the vaccine. I'm sorry, but you can't fly anymore. So this question is a really important one. I also told you about the Seattle mom or the Seattle area mom, 37 years old, good health. Wants to be a room mom to her kids at school. They said, you can't come in unless you're vaccinated. Those are the new rules. And she got the vaccine and died a short time later, the autopsy showing that she died from vaccine-induced thrombocytic cytopenia. So she died because of the vaccine. Is it common? No. Is it one of the effects, though? Yes. Was CDC keeping an eye on it? Well, they claimed that they did so starting in February of last year, about the right time that they would have seen millions and millions of Americans being vaccinated. And so they should have been paying attention to VAERS. CDC, this is a quote, CDC performed analysis between March 25 of 2022 and July 31 of this year. So they did an analysis of VAERS. CDC also recently addressed a previous statement made to the Epoch Times clarifying PRR, these are, you know, taking a look at reviews of the adverse effects, were not run between February of 21 and September of 2021. Walensky's agency has promised in several documents starting as early as 2021 to perform a type of analysis called a proportional reporting ratio on reports submitted to the VAERS system, which it helps manage. But the agency said in June it didn't do them. It also said performing them was actually outside of the agency's purview. So here they are saying we did do these proportional reporting ratios on the adverse events that were happening. And then they said not only did we not do them, our agency isn't even allowed to do them. It's outside of our lane. Confronted with the contradiction, Dr. John Hsu, a CDC official, said in July of this year that the agency started doing those PRRs in February of last year and, quote, continues to do so to date. But a few weeks later, the CDC contradicted him, said, no, we're not doing them. CDC performed PRRs March of this year through July of this year, Walensky's new letter, dated September 2nd, sent on the 6th of September of this year to Senator Ron Johnson, shows that Walensky is aware that her agency gave false information. Now, why is that important? Number one, is it their job to keep an eye on the safety and efficacy of these kinds of vaccines? Apparently, they say today it's not their job. Did they claim that they were actually doing that job starting in February of last year? Yes, they did claim that they were doing it. Have they now contradicted themselves and say, no, not only were we not doing them, we didn't even have the authority. It was outside the purview of our agency. Now, if you have people who say, why don't you trust the medical system? And why don't you trust the government? This is one of the key reasons that people don't trust government agencies, because they lie like rugs. They lie on a regular basis. They lie like Dr. Fauci lied to cover his backside because of connections to China and that sort of thing. And they lie when it comes to people's health and when it comes to people's safety. It's dead wrong. It does damage, and it shouldn't be happening. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your calls. I'll do that in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll. You can find that two places, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. And if you don't like Twitter, go to my website. It's LarsLarson.com. Giancarlo Canaparo is a legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and he joins me now. Giancarlo, how are you doing?
Lars, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm curious. I wanted to talk to you about some of the crazy decisions that are being made by the current administration based on COVID, except that I want to preface this by asking you, aren't we, for all intents and purposes, getting past the pandemic, even though Joe Biden still claims we're in the middle of a national emergency?
Well, you don't really know asking Joe Biden. Now, Joe Biden does claim we're in the middle of an emergency. In fact, he relied on the COVID-19 emergency to find some flimsy legal basis to forgive student loans.
That's
but
where
even
I was going.
Biden doesn't seem right. Even Biden doesn't seem to know whether we're in a pandemic or not. He has flip-flopped constantly over the course of his administration as it suits him. So you might recall, in early 2021, the Centers for Disease Control published a bunch of studies that said it was safe to reopen schools. Biden quashed those recommendations and then issued new guidance prepared by a teachers union to keep schools locked down. But just a couple months later, Biden was celebrating America's independence on the 4th of July, not from Great Britain, but from COVID. But then issued a new eviction moratorium on the grounds that we were still in a very dangerous, challenging time. But then he tried to end Title 42 just a couple months later, which allows border agents to expel illegal immigrants to reduce the spread of the disease. And he said it's no longer necessary because conditions are improving. But just 2 weeks later, he then extended the emergency declaration again. Then Anthony Fauci, just 2 weeks after that, said we are out of the pandemic. And then just a couple months after that, Biden extended the emergency moratorium again. So you have no idea if you get your news from the administration whether we're in an emergency or not. What you can say for sure is that it depends on if it's politically useful for him.
Well, and that's it. Politically useful for him, expensive for the rest of us, because at the time he announced the student loan payoff, you know, payoff of all these loans, and we're talking, depending on which estimate you're looking at, upwards of $900 billion, which I'm sure with interest will turn into $1 trillion of debt for our great-grandchildren. And I said, legally, how can he do that? And everybody kind of shrugged until he finally came out with a plan and said, oh, he's doing it under the HEROES Act. And you say, well, the HEROES Act, that was about 9/11. And it was designed to benefit first responders like firefighters and cops and paramedics. And it was designed to benefit members of the military who found themselves caught in a bind because of the response to 9/11. How does that apply now? And they say, well, the Congress passed a law and it says it applies either during war. Well, we're not in a war right now, although we're funding one in Ukraine, or it applies during a national emergency. And I said, we're still in a national emergency? Who thinks that? And like you said, it seems as though Joe Biden is deciding it either is or isn't a national COVID emergency or pandemic, depending on which direction he needs to go politically. Is that what we should conclude?
I mean, that's the only conclusion we can reach. It seems like every couple months, sometimes just weeks go by when Biden changes his mind on whether we're in a COVID emergency or not. And it depends on whether he needs some new emergency powers or whether he wants to claim that he's improved so much over President Trump. But he can't have it both ways, but he's determined to try.
Well, and the sad thing is that most of the media doesn't want to hold this guy to account at all. That's number one. But number two, just to make sure they aren't ever tempted to do that, he hasn't sat down for an interview in well over 200 days. So he lets Karine Jean-Pierre walk out there and be his mouthpiece on all these things. And she doesn't know what's going on. She actually today she referred to the Infrastructure Reduction Act instead of the Inflation Reduction Act, because and it was great because it was one of those Washington gaffes where somebody slips and actually tells the truth. But you think she's going to give you a definitive answer? So if a reporter were able to say, Mr. President, are we in an emergency or not? Are we in a COVID emergency? And he was actually pressed to the point where he had to say, yes, we are, or no, we're not. Then you could ask, no matter which direction he went, you could ask, well, if we're not in an emergency, why are you doing all these things under emergency powers? And if we are under an emergency, why are you giving up, for example, Title 42? But neither one makes sense, and none of it is consistent.
No, that's exactly right. And it just underscores the point that what Biden's doing here is not lawful. He's not even pretending it's lawful. He decided that he's got a political win that he wants, and he's going to do it. And, you know, who cares about the law?
Yeah, so where do
Which
we go
is
from
about,
here?
You know, his attitude for a lot of laws.
Is there any way that the American public can get something done to either make the things happen that ought to be happening, like Title 42, control the border, or like saying there is no emergency anymore, so forget about the $500 billion or $600 billion that we're going to throw away paying off bad student loan debt?
Well, the best solution is to vote the bums out in the upcoming election. But there are potentially judicial avenues, at least with respect to the student loans. The question of whether or not loan forgiveness is illegal is a pretty easy one. It's not legal.
Right.
The question of who could sue is a little harder, but you know, we're making some good progress on that front. And my sense is that we're going to be able to find some litigants that may satisfy the standing requirement.
Well, see, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I've been talking to a bunch of lawyers who say it doesn't look like anybody has standing. And I said, you mean the president of the United States can do something that costs at least $500 billion, might end up costing $1 trillion, and do it in violation of the law and the Constitution above and beyond his authority? Congress could do it, but they aren't going to do it. But Joe's going to do it on his own. And everybody agrees it's illegal for him to do it. But nobody has standing in the courts to actually challenge an American president who's doing something that's illegal that has a price tag of at least $500 billion?
Well, I think that's what Biden was banking on. But as I and some of my colleagues are starting to dig into this legal research, it's looking like there are some entities that may have standing. So I'll follow up with you and give you the final answer in a couple weeks.
Well, I certainly hope so. And one of these days, Joe is going to find himself close enough to reporters that they might actually get to ask a question. I think that'd be a great question. Mr. President, are we still in a COVID emergency or not? And I'd like a yes or a no to it, because it's a binary question. It's not one of those, well, we're kind of in, we're kind of not. Tell us what it is. Now, I know he's a confused old man today. He actually said, why, I've been in the Senate for 720 years. I don't know where that one came from. That's not only a slip of the tongue. It seems like your presidency is about 700 years long, but that's more an emotional reaction to the last 18 months rather than actually a factual question. But he doesn't seem to know where he is most of the time.
Well, that's about right, I think.
Giancarlo, it's always a pleasure. That is Giancarlo Canaparo, who's a legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Let's hope they find a way to actually walk into the courts and say, by the way, Judge, this president is violating these laws. He's about to spend or wants to spend $500 billion of your money. He's claiming he has emergency powers, and yet he's said on numerous occasions we're no longer in a COVID emergency. Well, Joe, which one is it, one or the other? 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Valhalla Tea Company. It's made by veterans to help veterans by donating $1 from every bag sold at ValhallaTea.com. Our Twitter poll today, and I'd love to see you vote in. It doesn't cost anything. Might be habit forming, though. Should all negotiations about government employee contracts be done in public? The case in point that I've cited these kind of cases over the years, when the Seattle Education Association that represents all those teachers says, well, we're going to go on strike. And now it sounds like they've worked out a deal that will end the strike after the kids have been out of school for a few days. And the public says, well, what was the final deal? What was the final raise that they arrived at? And the answer is, we don't know. You say, hold on a second. So the teachers know what the final arrangement was. Their union knows. The school board knows. All the folks in the education establishment know what the deal is. And the only folks who are kept in the dark are those people who are actually paying the bill. Should all government employee union contract negotiations be done in public so that public knows what's at issue? And when we hear the answer, well, we'll be glad to tell you what's in the deal once it is signed and final and there is no going back, that's not good enough. If we're writing the checks, and I am a Washington State taxpayer, I'm writing some of the checks, you're writing some of the checks, we ought to know what the deal is before it's finally signed off. Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to Mike. Hey, Mike, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. It's really great to speak with you. I've just been real curious about the governor's race. If we don't get a decent form of government here, we're going to be in real trouble. But none of them have ever brought up reinstating the death penalty or making the penalties for crime worse or building back our police.
Actually, Christine Drazen, the GOP nominee, has said she wants the tough penalties back for violent crime. I haven't actually asked her specifically about the death penalty that I can recall. I've always thought the death penalty was a sensible way to go. The public supports it. But the next time Drazen's on, I'll ask her. And the next time Betsy Johnson's on, I'll ask her. I guarantee you that Tina Kotek is not in favor because Tina Kotek was part of the legislature that gutted the death penalty. Officially, the penalty is still on the books, but it requires such a special combination of factors that effectively they've kept it on the books because that kept them from having to go back to the public and ask. But what they've also done is they've said, but we're only going to use it extraordinarily rarely, and I think that's just dead wrong. The death penalty actually works. It deters murder, and it ought to be, and since it's on the books, it ought to actually be used. Let's go to John. Hey, John, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. Just kind of curious, has anybody put any thought about a rigged or cheated election in Oregon?
Yes.
The Democrats have seen it happen in D.C. They got away with it. They're still getting away with it. And who's to say over the last almost 30 years it hasn't happened here?
I think it has. And John, over the years, I've complained about vote by mail. And my primary complaint is that election fraud is nearly impossible to detect in the state. And you say,
right.
And if they say, well, we look for it. And I said, well, you don't look for it much, number one. But number two, even if you look for it, because Oregon and Washington are both entirely vote by mail, how would you detect it if it's happening? So what have we seen happen across the country in the 2020 election? We saw people vote ballots that they were not entitled to. They didn't live in the state or they voted twice. How would you detect that? And the answer is it's almost undetectable. We've also found at least one example that we documented of a foreign national who, over her own objections, was signed up to vote, was registered to vote. She went in to get a driver's license. They said, "You want to be signed up to vote?" And she said, "No, I'm here on a green card. I'm not entitled to vote." And they registered her anyway. And because she's honest and her husband's honest, they both contacted me. And I contacted the election authorities. And this is how you know they're not looking for it, John. They told me, "No, that's impossible. Right. We don't sign up foreign nationals to vote." And I said, "Well, this lady says she's signed up to vote. She says she told DMV, don't sign me up to vote, because she knew what her rights were as a green card holder, and voting is not one of them. And she was honest." When elections finally, and it's the guy who actually quit right before the 2020 election, Stephen Trout, who I'd love to talk to again, because he's the guy who warned the incoming Secretary of State, "The whole system has flaws. Here's how to fix them, and you won't fix them. You won't give us the computers. You won't give us the ability to fix these problems." And then he mysteriously quit, and we haven't heard from him since. Now, I expect he's out there, and he wants to preserve his ability to get a job somewhere in state government. So I don't know where he is, and I have nothing bad to say about the guy. When he finally acknowledged, "Yeah, we did sign up a foreign national to vote, and yeah, we had no idea we had done that," And he even denied. It's like asking somebody, "Do you have this problem?" And they say, no, I don't." And then they find out they do, and they admit to you, "Yeah, we had a problem, and it's the kind of problem that we don't believe even exists or even is possible, but you did identify it." Then that tells you, even if they look for it, you can't find it. So if you have foreign nationals signed up to vote, the only way you're going to find out is if those foreign nationals actually tell you, "I was signed up to vote," when they knew they had no legal right to be signed up to vote, and that's not going to happen very often. It's a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's the Lars Larson Show.